Hi, everybody. Welcome to all of you at our latest Investec Economics webcast. I'm Philip Shaw. I look after the economics team here for Investec in London. This week, I'm delighted to have Andrew Mitchell with us. He's a Conservative MP for the Royal Town of Sutton Coalfield. He's a former cabinet minister, having served as International Development Secretary under David Cameron between 2010 and 2012, and having also been the shadow secretary for 5 years. That, of course, was back in the good old days when there was a Department for International Development. Good morning, Andrew. I hope the Commons debate yesterday wasn't too bruising.
No, but it was very interesting. We might come on and talk about some of that later.
Okay, well, it's 6 months to the day now that Boris Johnson announced the full lockdown in March. Much has happened since, of course, but yesterday we had the Prime Minister announce a new set of restrictions and warning that we may have to live with them for another 6 months. The plan today is for me to make a few points on the economy, including the latest state of the UK-EU trade negotiations and prospects of fiscal policy as well. Andrew will then look at the situation from a political perspective, and of course we'll have a question and answer session at the end. First though, could I make the usual housekeeping points? All attendees will be automatically on mute. To submit a question, please use the Q&A feature on the right of your screens, type your question in and select ask all panelists to submit it. If you have any problems with the audio, let us know, type into the Q&A section and our AV team will get in touch. This session is being recorded and our comments do not constitute investment advice. And if you're new to these sessions, you'll receive an email at the end to ensure that you can sign up for future updates. Okay, well, what we saw yesterday was a debate in Parliament on what has become the infamous UK Internal Market Bill. Now, it's hugely complex, but in short, the purpose of the bill, at least as I understand it, is to ensure the functioning of the UK as one entity with respect to common rules, non-discrimination between various parts of the country. The main problem, of course, is, as you may have read, is with Northern Ireland, where the relationship with Great Britain is also governed by the EU withdrawal agreement in order to maintain a seamless border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, to ensure the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement is maintained. And just to simplify, the issues were connected with the bill were the bill insisting on UK autonomy on state aid to companies in Northern Ireland, and whether to follow the EU customs code for goods shipped from Northern Ireland to Britain. Now, procedures for the former, at least, are in the withdrawal agreement, and that is an international treaty. Non-compliance with that would thus be a breach of international law. Well, it looks after yesterday that the passage of the bill may have been delayed. The press this morning is suggesting that the second reading in the Lords will take place in mid-October at the earliest. But even so, the episode has raised tensions further between the UK and the EU. The EU has said that it's examining all options, including legal action. It's also exposed the extent to which uncertainty remains over a functioning free trade agreement, and that has to be struck, our guess is realistically, by early November at the latest. Now, our main view is that this is still possible. If you look at certain reports, they're saying that actually talks at negotiator level are going better than the recent row at government level suggests. And we've got Barnier in London today for informal talks. The joint committee between the two parties meets again formally on Monday. So our baseline view is still deal rather than no deal, but they're has to be now a greater risk of a lack of an agreement. And we're not really surprised on the back of all of this that sterling has dropped by between 7 to 8 cents against the US dollar from its peak. That's mainly on Brexit news, but it should be remembered also that the what we've got is the current risk-off environment in world markets. Generally, sterling does badly in that case. On a successful FTA, of course, we'd expect the pound to rally perhaps back to the mid-30s by the end of the year. So let's chat about the economy for a while. What's our view of economic prospects? As those of you who are regular may remember, our broad view for quite some time has been that the economy would stage a sharp but partial recovery over the spring and summer months before beginning to lose momentum. And really, recent data have borne that out. If anything, we'd be marginally less optimistic about the speed of the upturn. But the official numbers show GDP rising by 6.6% in July after, I think, 8.7% in June. That's on the month. August looks set to be good as well. Retail spending still robust, at least for now. So I think overall we could be looking at something like a 9% contraction in the economy this year, which would represent a downgrade in our view by about half a percentage point. So in terms of how the economy is going to go from here, I think that's the last of the low-hanging fruit, I'm afraid, not only because Eat Out to Help Out has expired, and also we're just not easing restrictions, and of course the direction of travel is in the other direction, particularly given Boris's address yesterday. About half an hour ago, we had the first cut of September's PMIs in the UK, Purchasing Managers Indices. That's a key survey. And that, if anything, showed some easing of that momentum, which has been building up since May. And for the remainder of the year, obviously, what's critical is how the COVID infections respond to the latest measures. Yesterday's figures showed new cases up over 4,900, and that leaves the seven-day average somewhere around 4,000. Whether you call that exponential growth or following a logistical path doesn't really matter so much. And what we do know is that if daily cases don't begin to fall relatively quickly, we will get more lockdown measures introduced. And from our perspective, we'll be closer to a downside case on GDP. So those infection rates over the next 2 to 3 weeks are going to be critical in that respect. I'll just make a few individual points. Lockdown rules, liberal Sweden or restrictive New Zealand? I'm finding that as almost as polarizing as Brexit, having heard vociferous arguments on this from both sides. And I'm usually pretty eager to wade into debates, but I'll stay neutral on this one. And at this stage, I'll just supply a couple of facts. On the death rate, Sweden's death rate totaled just under 6,000. That's, I think, 580 per million inhabitants. New Zealand's at 25. That's 5 per million. In terms of economic performance, if you look at the GDP loss between Q2 and the end of last year, Sweden fell by 8.1%, New Zealand by 10.9%. You also have to take account of a wide number of factors when making an assessment, including population density, the structure of the economy, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot more complex than just looking at those figures at face value. But I do hear some strange numbers being bandied about. So, you know, I hope that that helps with at least some basic facts. On monetary policy, last Thursday, markets seemed to be surprised at a line in the minutes from the Monetary Policy Committee that the BOE was due to start constructive engagement with the PRA on a negative rate or a bank rate or base rate. We already know that negative rates are part of the Bank of England's toolkit, albeit not its preferred instrument. It would also be a highly technical move, which needs extensive preparation. So getting the groundwork done now doesn't mean that it's imminent or even likely. And, you know, I'd note that Andrew Bailey basically said that precisely yesterday. On fiscal policy, I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago stories surrounding the prospect of higher corporation tax, capital gains tax, and more restrictions on tax relief on pension contributions. Sure, there is absolutely a need to address a budget deficit, which is very likely to surpass £300 billion this year, and to limit the rise in outstanding debt, which has already reached £2 trillion. But maintaining the UK's fiscal credibility is paramount. But does the Chancellor want to commit to major tightening in fiscal policy while the economy is fragile? And in our view, the answer has to be no. Perhaps an answer is to pre-announce at least the bigger rises to take place over the coming years, not straight away. And that's an approach taken by Ken Clark when he was Chancellor. I think it was his 1993 and 1994 budgets. We don't even know for sure whether there will be a budget yet, though November continues to be talked about. Note, though, before that, Rishi Sunak is going to have to decide to do what to do with the furlough scheme, CJRS. Obviously, he can't wait until a November budget, as the CJRS is due to expire at the end of October. He has been saying reasonably consistently that it's counterproductive to let firms survive as zombie companies. But I think there has to be a case for some sort of targeted support, especially if the reason why companies are struggling are the government restrictions on their activities. And indeed, press speculation this morning suggests that the Treasury is looking at some sort of wage subsidy scheme, although nothing has been decided for sure yet. Well, I hope I've teed up Andrew nicely on a couple of subjects here. We're all very much looking forward to what you've got to say. Over to you.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to take part in this Investec webinar. I've had the pleasure and privilege of being an advisor to Investec now for something like 6 years. They're a great firm to work with, and Phil and I have done a sort of double act on a number of occasions. He certainly is always worth listening to because of his economic grasp and his predictions, not only on the economy either. He's pretty good on football. So it's a pleasure to take part with him today. Now, what I wanted to do was to talk for about 15 minutes about the challenges facing the government now. And this is a generational crisis, that is clear to everybody. And when it started as a member of parliament, we realized that parliament was not going to be able to play an effective role in holding the government, the executive, to account. And you will remember that we passed these very draconian laws giving the government basically carte blanche to do whatever it wants in the national interest. And we did it with a very heavy heart, and Parliament inserted into the legislation a requirement for the government to come back after 6 months and get those powers renewed. And from then on, members of Parliament dispersed around their constituencies and dealt with the crisis as best they could as members of Parliament. And that meant that we were in many ways tied to the parish pump in our constituencies, although not literally, because, for example, I was in a very pleasant house with a garden and able to look after my constituents from there. And tied to the parish pump, I dealt with everyday different problems which were causing anxiety in the royal town. For example, at the start of the crisis, we had something like 70 people who were stuck in Australasia. I noticed that my constituents seemed to like going to the other side of the world. I hope it's nothing to do with a member of parliament. But we had, for example, therefore, to keep the hub open in Singapore so that they could get back. And really, for about 100 days, parliament couldn't sit, couldn't hold the executive to account, and had to do its very best remotely, sometimes with very faulty Wi-Fi, to stand up for their constituents. And it was a most unattractive period. And of course, one of the things about being tied to the parish pump is you get to see all the people in business who are desperately trying to ensure that their staff have a job to come back to, who are determined to use the ingenuity and the spirit of the private sector to keep their businesses going. And, you know, since the lockdown ended, I've visited a large number of businesses in my constituency and seen the sort of determination and grit to bring their staff back off furlough, to find new and ingenious ways in the new market of being successful and keeping the show on the road. And it's a humbling experience to meet the dynamos of the British economy. Now, Parliament isn't functioning still today. And we have it to vote. We are socially distanced. We queue up round the block. Only a very small number of people can get into the chamber because of social distancing, quite rightly. But you can see how it makes holding the executive to account quite difficult. And the executive has never needed to be held to account as much as it does today, because there are four big problems that the executive face and two interrelated little ones. And any one of those problems would be enough for a government to cope with. But to have to face all four of them is a very big challenge indeed. And let me just briefly sketch out what those four are. First of all, they are the economic challenges which Phil referred to, but which are very great indeed. And when the furlough scheme lifts, we stand to see large amounts of unemployment across our country. And I'm old enough to have been around in the 80s. I was first in Parliament in 1987. And I remember when unemployment approached 3 million. And some of the prospects today, some of the analysis suggests that unemployment in Britain could be even higher than that. And I don't think many politicians remember or understand just what that means. I mean, 3 million people unemployed means that every street, every community, every constituency up and down the country will be affected by the misery that goes on behind the lace curtains. And, you know, this is a very serious challenge for any government. And we hope and pray that there will be a V-shaped recovery. But we've seen from the market reactions this week, we've seen that this crisis is ever present and dangerous and never more so than for our economy. And the second big problem related to that is, of course, the problems of coronavirus directly and the threat to our health service. We are tracking behind France and Spain. And last week, there were no intensive care beds at all in Marseille, one of the biggest cities in France. And, you know, if we are tracking behind them, we can see the very great stresses that could be laid upon our health service. Nightingale Hospital in Birmingham is now on 48-hour notice, and we've seen the hospital admissions rise. We are beginning to see the infection rate rise in the way that Phil described, and I very much fear the death rate will be following it. So the second big problem is, how do you balance the necessary position in the health service to keep the health service from going under, to keep it able to function effectively and properly? And how do you look after the interests of an economy which couldn't in any case face another lockdown? It just wouldn't be practical. A national lockdown would destroy the future prospects for so many in our country. Thirdly, the third big problem is, of course, Brexit. Now, given that the transition period ends on December the 31st, and as of today, there is no deal, you might have expected that to be the first problem. But the fact that it is the third on my list demonstrates the challenges that the government faces. And I agree with Phil. I have always believed that there would be a deal. And we'll come back to the internal market bill perhaps later on or in questions. But I think there will be a deal, and my fingers are crossed that there will be. And today we have a statement from Michael Gove in the House of Commons on the ending of the transition period, the preparations that Britain is making for no deal. And we ballot to be able to get into these statements. And I've come out sixth today. So I'll be going down after this to the House of Commons to flag up for Michael and for the government the critical importance of the automotive industry across the West Midlands, where thousands of our constituents and in the automotive industry more generally, tens of thousands of our constituents' livelihoods depend upon that and the terms and conditions for continuous supply which follow from the end of the transition period, particularly if there is no deal. So that the third problem facing the government is Brexit. And the fourth problem is the union. I spent time this summer in Scotland, and it is clear that sentiment is hardening against the union, this union which has been so successful now for more than 300 years. And I don't want to be part of a generation of politicians that lost the union. But the union is under great threat, and the events in Ireland, which Phil referred to, underline the pressures on the union in Northern Ireland too. So that is a real problem for the government, for which there is no solution at the moment. And in my view, you can't hold out against another referendum forever. It's anti-democratic. And the way through, I think, is to have a referendum on what would be the terms of the departure of Scotland, so that people know what they are voting for. And unlike with Brexit, they know what the effects would be of the union coming to an end. So that's the fourth problem. Now, I mentioned two lesser problems, and you know, some people will argue that they're every bit as important as the other four, and that is climate change and British leadership next year in the Conference of Parties, the COP, in Glasgow, which is scheduled to take place next year in November. And this is a very big issue, particularly for younger people. And if you look at its salience on all the research, if you're under 35 years old, this is very close to the top of your list of priorities. And Britain will be in a leadership position there, and we will see what Global Britain means, because the other issue which goes with this is the integrated review. It is the security and defence review, a very big and important issue for Britain. It's what global Britain means. It's what Britain's offer to the world is. And I was one of those on the National Security Council who helped conduct the major review in 2010, 2011, when the Conservatives were elected to government in coalition. And it's very important that we get this right, because it's how we position our country around the world. What matters to us? What are Britain's international interests? And carrying out that review, which always comes down to money in the end, is incredibly important. And it fits absolutely in with climate change, where younger people want Britain to lead a really strong international effort. I mentioned just two things which were raised with me in recent days. One is that many members of the younger generation are horrified by the melting of the ice caps and wondering whether this will be the last generation that knows and sees what a polar bear is. And also that plastic in the oceans and the damage that's been done to marine life means that plastic has now washed up on the shores of St. Helena, the remotest place, thousands of miles from any other landmass, right out there in the middle of the South Atlantic. And, you know, our generation has a duty, has an obligation. As Mrs. Thatcher once said, we are leaseholders, not freeholders of the planet. We have an absolute duty to play our part in mitigating and then eliminating the effects of climate change. So those two issues are related. As I said, the way in which Britain wires together its defence policies, its diplomacy policies, and its development policies, the way we do that and the influence we have outside of the British Isles, which is for our benefit as well as our contribution internationally, where we have always punched above our weight, partly because we have one of the five permanent seats on the UN, partly because we're the second biggest and most effective contributor to NATO, partly because we are one of the leading figures in the Commonwealth, which is a big North-South organization, partly because of the English language, the primacy of British law and administrative and dispute resolution, and also because inside or outside the European Union, we are still a major European power. So what Britain does, what Britain stands up for, is very important. And in the heat of the generational crisis of coronavirus, we shouldn't forget those things. So those are the four plus two half problems that the government is challenged to face. And the government was set up by Boris Johnson very much as a Brexit government before coronavirus hit, before these other problems emerged. And it was set up as a very controlling government, if you like, with Boris Johnson as the chairman of the board and Dominic Cummings as the chief executive. And whatever you think about Dominic Cummings, he's not entirely wrong. What he says about the civil service, for example, is, in my judgment, partly true. The civil service does need to add to its DNA a different sort of official, a different sort of background experience and skill set. But equally, it's not a sensible thing to do to brutalize the civil service as it is already. It's much better to mold it and add to it. So he's not entirely wrong, but he's clearly an immensely divisive figure, a sort of Svengali in Downing Street. And this sort of control structure, where you don't really have ministers with experience out running departments, you have people who have been faithful to Brexit and who are motivated by their loyalty to Boris, that is not a government of great depth. And Downing Street can play this role as a sort of controller of everything. Tony Blair tried it for a period of time when he was in government. But they can do this for a period of time. But when you've got multiple incoming from a whole series of different crises, to have a government which doesn't have great depth is an additional challenge. So I think that makes the government's task in tackling these challenges all the more difficult. Well, today we will have in Parliament, as I mentioned, the important statement about what happens if there is no deal. We're also, for example, today having the second reading, so the acceptance in principle of a bill to limit the way our military are going after are being gone after many years after the events by lawyers acting for enemy parties. And you know, it's important that any military person is held to account. And lawfare, this business of lawyers getting involved, is very, very unattractive. But equally, it comes to where I started my comments about the importance of Parliament holding the government to account. And there is an inadequate definition in the bill of the utter repugnance and never acceptance of torture. And so, you know, I and others today will be trying to make sure that the government recognizes that torture is never acceptable and that the bill reflects that and doesn't allow a time limit on breaches of the Geneva Convention in torture to go ahead. So you see really where I started, that there's a role for Parliament in these crises, which is greatly fettered, but which members of Parliament, looking after the interests of their constituents, must be able to exercise. Thank you.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. That was very entertaining, as well as very informative. We've got a number of questions already, but I think I'd like to ask my own question, if I may. And that's, you are a former International Development Secretary. How did you react when the countries you were dealing with threatened to break international law? Is it a big deal?
No, it's a very big deal. And when you hear William Hague and Michael Howard, both former leaders of the Conservative Party, condemning a Conservative government for something it's doing, when you have the last Prime Minister refusing to support a measure, then people should stop and think. And I reacted quite strongly. I reacted on the Today programme that it's quite wrong to expect people to vote to break the law. Britain has been around the world a beacon, standing up for some very important values. They're not British values, a phrase I rather dislike. They're international values which Britain supports. Freedom under the law, liberty to speak your mind, a free press, you know, the right to life, the right to safety. These are international virtues under the rule of law that Britain has spoken up for all around the world and is respected for what it has said. So the idea that a British government would say quite brazenly that it was going to break the law is quite appalling. And, you know, this is a very good bill, by the way, until you get to those clauses, because it's setting up an orderly internal market within Britain, which is essential when we come to December the 31st, whether we have a deal or not. You've got to have an orderly market. And nor do I think that the EU are negotiating in good faith at the moment, because they offered Theresa May effectively a Canada-style deal, and they're not offering that to Boris. So, you know, I don't have any sympathy for the EU, but you can't react to that by threatening to break the law. And you know, I've been in Parliament so long, I've voted for things that I've subsequently regretted, like the Iraq war and clause 28 and the poll tax even, but I've never gone into the lobby to vote for something I knew was wrong. And that's why a number of us insisted that the government at the very least deferred any question of that until there'd been a vote of the House of Commons. And the government incorporated that into the bill, so I was able to support the bill as it stands. But if they do come back with those clauses going live, I shall definitely vote against it. And of course, it's very bad for the party to whip people to do something like this, because although people will vote for the government out of a mixture of loyalty or careerism and ambition, they know they're doing something wrong when they go through the lobbies, and they will resent it deep down. And of course, Downing Street, knowing that they've managed to herd people to do something so unprincipled, will have even greater contempt than they do at the moment for Parliament and parliamentarians. And that's very bad for them. So the whole thing is quite appalling. And that's why, although I'm a former chief whip, I felt it incumbent upon me to speak out. But never mind me. You've also got three former leaders, one of them a prime minister, two of them absolutely steeped in the Brexiteer movement, both of them leaders of the Brexiteer movement, saying that this is completely wrong.
OK, moving on towards coronavirus type issues. For the moment, I know it wasn't your address yesterday, but what do you think the economic rationale was for telling businesses that the lockdown could last as long as 6 months?
Well, I hope, very much hope it won't. And I think that it's to warn people that this is a crisis which has a long tail. And, you know, I don't think that the public locked down in the early days because some grey-haired suited man stood behind a podium in Downing Street and told them to do it. I think people in Britain, they follow their instincts and their interests. And the lockdown, which was highly effective at the beginning, was because people realised that if they didn't obey the lockdown and sign up for it, then they were putting their health at very serious risk. Now, the longer the crisis goes on, the more blasé people become about it. And I mean, I was asked on the Channel 4 News at 7 o'clock last night didn't I think it was a bit silly stopping pubs and restaurants closing at 10? And I don't think it's silly at all, because if you think about it, if you go to the pub and you're there beyond 10 o'clock at night, you're probably drinking a bit, you become less inhibited, and you may not social distance in the same way, and you have a few more drinks. And, you know, I think actually it's quite a sensible move to keep people socially distanced. And the government is trying to reach for a sensible middle way, but to warn that this is indeed a crisis with a long tail, and getting that balance right between economic interests and health interests of the population is vitally important. I mean, I recoiled completely from this suggestion that people should snitch on their neighbours. It's very un-British to try and set up a sort of East Germany Stasi organisation from 1955. I think it's very unattractive indeed. So I won't be snitching on my neighbours. But if, you know, if they're having what the Prime Minister, I think, called an animal house party, then that's a different matter. But I think that the idea that we have people hiding behind the curtains and snooping out on their neighbours, I think is extremely unattractive. And we should steer away from that sort of thing. What we're appealing to people to have is social solidarity, to do the right thing by their neighbours and by themselves, and protect themselves and their friends and loved ones and neighbours. And we should appeal for social solidarity, in my view.
Okay, next question is a bit of a long one. It's a two-part question. I'll paraphrase it, and perhaps I'll do the first bit and you can do the second bit, Andrew. And it's to do with data distortion created by false positive readings of coronavirus testing. And the second part is to do with are the Cabinet deliberately misleading Parliament to provide cover for past mistakes. So I'll do the first bit. And I have seen some literature about on false positives. Now, a false positive is, you know, when the test says that you have the coronavirus when you haven't got it. And there's one particular piece of literature I've seen, which is that, okay, on average, in certain places, 2% of people are testing positively, and that some tests are provide 2% false positives. And the conclusion this particular author has reached is that, well, 2% false positives, 2% people testing positives, therefore the coronavirus does not exist. The technical flaw in that argument is that the false positives only relate to the tests which are positive. So the 2% is 2% of 2%, so 98% of the 2% are showing correctly that people have the coronavirus. So there's a little bit of a conspiracy theory, I think, in the previous argument, which I hope I have dealt with. But Andrew, do you think that senior cabinet members are deliberately misleading Parliament here?
I mean, is there a specific example that was cited of a cabinet minister misleading Parliament?
Not specifically. I think one of the people mentioned is the health secretary.
Yes, I mean, for a cabinet minister to mislead Parliament is for any minister to mislead Parliament is an incredibly serious offence. And you know, as someone who's on the back benches, you know, I can get up and have my say and I can say what I like, and I do. And when I was a minister, though, I was unbelievably careful that I did not say something that I subsequently needed to correct. It's a very demeaning experience having to go back to the House of Commons and say, I got it wrong, I'm terribly sorry. And ministers rightly are terrified of misleading Parliament, and woe betide us if we get to the point when they're not. And although sometimes I think the Prime Minister wings it a bit when it comes to facts and figures in the House of Commons, he's now up against a prosecutor in Keir Starmer, who is very good on facts and figures. And so he will be held to account for that. I mean, many people were surprised that Brandon Lewis, the Northern Ireland Secretary, brazenly said to the House of Commons, the government is proposing to break the law in a certain and specific way, I think was more or less what he said. And people were surprised that. I'm not surprised at all, because he will have looked at what he was doing and he will have said to himself, well, what happens if I'm asked about this? What happens if they say, does this legislation seek to break the law, break an international treaty deposited in New York? And he'll have said to himself, well, the last thing I'm going to do is say no, if it's there quite absolutely clearly. You could have argued that he could have put it in a different way. But I think that Brandon Lewis said to himself, I'm not going to be caught on this hook. If I'm asked this question, I'm going to give an absolutely searingly accurate answer. And I have no doubt that there were people afterwards who called for Hansard and were astonished that he said that. But I think he did that for a very good reason. So without a specific example from our colleague who asked that question, I would just make the point that it's a very serious offence, and woe betide any minister who deliberately does it.
Okay, the next question is entirely for yourself, Andrew. I think three-part question. Two parts are technical, but perhaps you'd like to express a view. The third one, I'm sure you'd love to answer it. The first part of the question is, should NHS test and trace be run by the NHS and GPs, testing more at university labs and private institutions and away from private companies? Second part is, do you have a view on the Army's role on testing logistics? And the third bit, will Boris survive this Parliament?
Well, on test and trace, obviously the thing's pretty shambolic at the moment. And, you know, my line on this is, look, you know, there'll be time for remonstration and investigation and holding people to account and hanging them up publicly when this is all over. But now is not the time. And, you know, for me, it was always clear that the moment the schools went back, there'd be a huge demand for more testing. And that is what has happened. And, you know, I think they were warned that this would happen. And if you think about it, it's entirely logical. At the start of the winter term, kids who go back to school, they have colds and they pass them on to the teachers. And if you're ahead, you've got to be responsible, because you don't want to send these children and teachers out into the community spreading a virus. So and then, of course, once the demand for tests rocketed, the capacity for treating them went down for analysing the tests and returning the tests went down very sharply, and then people had to travel enormous number of miles to places. I see Aberdeen and Aberystwyth, which suggests that the logarithm that was sending them there tended to favour the start of the alphabet. So the thing was chaotic. But the answer now is to get it sorted as rapidly as possible and to bring in the private sector labs, all the labs, and for everyone to pile in and help resolve it. And that sort of comes to the second part of the question, the Army's role. I mean, the Army's role is not to put your neighbours up against the wall at the end of a rifle and tell them they're to obey the law. It's to provide logistics support. The Army is brilliant at logistics support. And for example, when I was strapped to the parish pump in Sutton Coldfield early on, the protection equipment, the PPE, was not getting to the care homes in my constituency. And we had this committee that was chaired by me and the co-chair, by me and the other ex-cabinet minister in Birmingham, which included the 11 constituencies, the local government, the police, the fire service, the NHS. And the clear answer was to get the Army to provide logistics support. And that's what they did. And they came in and they told people how to organise a hub and spoke operation. And they transformed the situation. And also what happened was, in my constituency, when the PPE wasn't getting out, the army put a whole load of stuff in the back of a four-tonner and dropped it off at the home. So, you know, this is what the army can do. So what you want from the army is their logistic grip and support, because they are brilliant at that sort of thing. And of course they are, because on occasions they have to put an expeditionary force into the field. They have to ensure that they have the right kit, that they get fed, that they have ammunition, all that support logistically. So they are the right people to engage on that. But it's not, you know, putting the military. I heard the expression putting the military on the street in support of the police. That sends all the wrong signals, in my view. What you've got to do is stand up for social solidarity and use the military's expertise as appropriate to help us in this fight against the coronavirus. Now, on the third part, Boris. You know, I mean, any prime minister would be facing a very great challenge at the moment. And he has a young fiance and a very young baby. And I think, you know, he's getting up and changing nappies in the middle of the night and so forth. And he's just got separated. He's just been very ill. It's a hell of an imposition. And of course, he's got a party where on the center left, they expect him to be a one nation prime minister, as he was a one nation mayor of London. And in the current environment, it's very difficult to be a one nation leader. And on the right, you know, they're worried about competence and they're worried about the mistakes, which, as I say, inevitably get made. And we should support, in my view, what the government is doing and remonstrate and recriminate later. His problem as a leader in the House of Commons comes from all these disparate groups who care about something very much. So people who care about the rule of law and are appalled by that, people who care about competence, people who care about the way the Brexit negotiations are going. There's a very strong lobby against liberalising planning law because the leafy shires could suffer and they're represented by Conservative members of Parliament. So if you are Boris, you don't want all these groups suddenly coalescing and charging at you. So I don't know whether he'll survive beyond this Parliament, but I do know this, that the public are much more sympathetic and forgiving of the government's handling of these crises and of coronavirus than the media and Westminster bubble are.
Interesting. The next question, I think, will lean on your expertise of the auto industry, given your base in the West Midlands, Andrew. And it is, will companies such as auto manufacturers use the economic crisis caused by the coronavirus as a force majeure to leave their bases in the UK and possibly going back on whatever promises they made after the referendum?
Well, you know, the automotive industry in the West Midlands, absolutely critical. Jaguar Land Rover is, as I said earlier, a huge, huge employer. And it's changed. I remember as a member of the Shadow Cabinet in 2008, going to the Castle Bromwich plant, which is where the Spitfire was made in the war. And two of the three production lines for Jaguar were mothballed. And at that stage, they were going cap in hand to Peter Mandelson, who was then the business secretary, to ask for support. And he faced them down. He wouldn't give them support. And yet 2 years later, you know, Jaguar Land Rover couldn't make enough cars to satisfy international demand. They were selling £10 billion worth of cars overseas and contributing to the Treasury, £1 billion, I think, in that year. So this is an industry which turns very fast. And it's also an industry where the future is in the next generation of electric cars. So, you know, for Jaguar, what we worry about is, will they say, well, look, for as long as there's a petrol and diesel engines, we'll go on making cars. But once it moves to the next generation, do they want to be in the UK? Do they want to continue this immense employment structure and car production structure in the United Kingdom? And you know, the petrol engine is going to be phased out. Government is looking at whether they can bring forward the period. And so we say, you know, are Jaguar Land Rover investing in the next generation? Is the gigafactory going to be located in the West Midlands. Where's it going to be? There's a site adjacent to my constituency where it could be. These are the questions. And so the answer to that is partly whether continuous supply is possible after December the 31st. If they can't do it, Jaguar Land Rover would need a warehouse, which would be one of the biggest structures on Earth. You'd be able to see it from the moon. So big would the warehouse need to be if continuous supply stopped. And we can't get into that. It's why, you know, I will use my opportunity today with Michael Gove to say that the interests of the automotive industry, they must be reflected very carefully by government. Governments do everything it can to make sure that after December the 31st, they're not faced with yet another problem as they battle changing technology, falling sales, difficult markets. Not another problem which makes their commitment to the UK weaken and dissipate.
Okay, the next question is how feasible do you think targeted financial support is to certain sectors, and can that be introduced? And I guess the subtext there is, where do you draw the line? How politically difficult will it be? And, you know, perhaps is it easier simply to extend the CJRS, the furlough scheme?
Well, on the first point, I mean, I think the furlough scheme has to come to an end at some point. And as you would be the first to say, Phil, persuading markets that the economic policy of the government is safe and sound is absolutely critical. And that's one of the reasons why threatening to break the law is so dangerous. Because what happens if the international markets say, well, you know, we've always assumed that Britain's word is its bond, and here we have a government cavalierly breaking an international treaty, which could be immensely damaging. So I trust the government to make the right dispositions, bearing in mind what I said earlier on about unemployment, that furlough must come to an end at some point. What is the balance of all of that? I trust the Treasury to make that decision. Now, on supporting, you know, you and I grew up knowing that government shouldn't pick winners. And interestingly, I went to see Rishi Sunak with Andy Street, the brilliant mayor of the West Midlands, a few weeks ago, to plead for support for Jaguar and for the automotive industry in the West Midlands. And I was very impressed by his reaction. I mean, he was sitting there behind a screen like a banker. He said, I've got a big bag of money. He was a banker, of course. I've got a big bag of money here. It belongs to the taxpayer. I've got to deploy it in the best way I can. And, everyone's coming and asking for money. You will note, he said, that the only subvention we've made so far was for the steel industry in Wales. It's quite a small deal. And in the end, he didn't offer anything to Jaguar at that point. And indeed, at the subsequent board meeting, Jaguar deferred making any strategic decisions about their operations in the West Midlands. So, you know, he's got a very tough job to do. But actually, I think it's quite good that you've got a banker there doing that job who will not be frightened and fazed by business people coming through the door saying, unless you give me £1 billion, we're going under tomorrow with the unemployment consequences. But who's got a good, strong team who look at what the best surgical interventions are on behalf of the taxpayer to maintain our economy. And that's the approach he's got to take as we try to make sure that this bounce back is V-shaped, not U-shaped or worse.
Right. I'm going to put two questions together here. They're sort of related and they both have the word Norway in them as well. So the first question is, given the closeness of the referendum in 2016, is the Norway approach not the best compromise? Alternatively, perhaps the Swiss model makes sense? And is it true that both were offered earlier in the negotiations but rejected? What are your thoughts? And the second question is, surely post-Brexit Britain should stop trying to punch above its weight, recognise its diminished military and political power and its smaller economy. Should we not become more like Norway and concentrate on running a respected small country?
Well, let's do the second part first, actually, because it's a very, very interesting question. And there's a book available in good booksellers by William Waldegrave. It's the last book he's written. And he goes through in that. He's one of the cleverest people I've ever met in politics. And he goes through the options for Britain now. And one of the options is to do exactly as your questioner suggested. It is to give up our seat at the UN, give up the nuclear deterrent, and concentrate on being a middle range power. And there's an argument for that. I think it would be extremely difficult for politicians to willingly downgrade the country, but there is an argument for that. I think that what the Integrated Review, the Security and Defence Review, should acknowledge is that Britain's interests are represented by values and not by geographies. For example, if you say America right or wrong, which is the geographic route, then you are always the little sister to America. And at the moment, we agree more with China on things like climate change and free trade than we do with Donald Trump. So Britain should support certain values, and we have an ability to punch above our weight for the reasons I gave earlier: the Commonwealth, the seat on the UN, the English language, NATO, being a European power. We stand at the crossroads of a lot of very important international organizations, and Britain drafts many of the resolutions at the United Nations. We have one of the best diplomatic services in the world. These are huge national assets, which are very good for us and very good for the international system, something that's very much on the back foot at the moment. So I am in favor of us punching above our weight. And I think the rubber hits the road, as I said, because it all comes down to resources, on the nuclear deterrent, which, you know, when we looked at it back in properly back in 2010, 2011, we decided that the case for renewing Trident was a very strong one. And nothing that's happened since convinces me that the world has become any safer. We have new and dangerous threats from a growing numbers of nuclear powers around the world. And I think we should be very careful at compromising in any way our defense posture. But it does all, I mean, the answer to the question inevitably comes down to resources. On Norway, the first part of the question, I think earlier on, there was a lot of, well, you know, what do you want? Do you want Norway? Do you want Switzerland? Do you want Canada? And the problem with Norway is you have to take all the EU regulations without having a seat at the table. It seems to me to be a very unsatisfactory position to be in. You just, in any negotiation, you're not there at the table. You've got your nose pressed up against the window outside. And you know, the Brexiteers, I think, with some justice, say, look, you know, we are now an independent sovereign state, and we want to be treated by the EU like a third country, like Canada, like Australia. And frankly, the argument about proximity, that we're quite close to those markets, are irrelevant. You know, we voted to leave, and we are a sovereign state. And I think the EU should accept that. But equally, we should accept that access to the biggest market in the world, the most affluent market in the world, 500 million people in the single market, something which Mrs. Thatcher championed and whipped on a three-line whip, whipped the Conservative Parliamentary Party to support the single market. There are huge benefits for Britain being in the single, being able to have access to the single market. And we should therefore be prepared to give a bit on that. So these two are very principled positions. We want to be an independent third country. They will say, well, look, we've got this single market which you helped set up, and there has to be, you know, some give and take on all of that. And I think both positions are principled, and that a deal ought to be able to be done. But, you know, it looks to me as if the Barnier negotiations a month or so ago included some pretty direct saber rattling about Northern Ireland. That's why the government wanted to put this revolver on the table, which they have done, I think, now. But breaking the law is something else.
We've got next question here, and I think we're down to our last three or four. Looks like it's from one of our corporate attendees who said, we've approached four banks under the government loan scheme, and such loans were deemed serviceable and affordable, but mainstream banks don't want to lend to non-existing clients. What's the government doing to encourage banks to lend?
On something, I've got a couple of cases like that in the constituency. I mean, can I just say rather directly to the person who asked that question, you should go and get hold of your Member of Parliament and get them to remonstrate with the bank chief executive and to raise it with treasury ministers or with biz ministers. Because, you know, this is an age-old tussle with the banks who, you know, the joint stock banks who tend to let you have an umbrella so long as it isn't raining. So I think that, you know, the government can cajole and speak out and influence. But when it comes down to a gritty issue like that, I would urge you to engage very directly through your Member of Parliament, who will then engage both with the bank and with the government for you.
Okay, I'd certainly add from an economics point of view that if you look at the lending numbers to corporates, that they've been very heavy since March, that large companies seem to have enough cash, but there is certainly a lot of demand for funds from the banks, from SMEs. So that really is, I think, a very live and very important issue. So last couple of questions I think we can just about squeeze in. With all the controversy during the summer over travel and quarantining, do you think a ban on non-essential and international travel should be the next step?
No, I'm opposed, as you will have gathered, to bans and sort of these sort of things if you can avoid them. And I think that we've got to get to a situation where people can come through airports and be tested rapidly. And the air, you know, the air bridge to New York is an inventive way of changing. But we know we can't, this if it goes on for 6 months, we simply cannot have people, international travel fettered any more than the absolute minimum. And so I'm in favor of being as inventive as possible and trying to get people back on planes. Having said that, you know, I mean, I've in my sort of business life, I found that Zoom genuinely means that quite a lot of the old business travel we all used to do can be, you know, dealt with by Zoom. I mean, I would reckon that quite a lot of the business travel I used to do at Lazard, I would say almost half of it could be replaced now by modern technology. So I think that the position has changed, but we must get people traveling, and we must ensure also for holidays and so on. These restrictions, particularly for young people, are so bad for people's mental health. Although this is a most unusual crisis, because, you know, in the war, the Second World War, the people in the front line were these brave pilots and brave soldiers. In this battle, the people in the front line are people on the minimum wage, working in care homes, risking their health. They are often migrant workers who come to Britain who are helping out. You know, it's not people living in houses with Zoom and big gardens. And the younger generation, too, you know, if you're in a bedsit, you can't go into the office. You've got your foot on the ladder. You're in a bedsit in the East End. And you're now fettered by these social and business restrictions. It's very, very hard. And I think it's the role of policymakers to do everything they can to move away from bans and try and lift restrictions within this balance of looking after public health and trying to support the economy. And, you know, mental health issues in Birmingham and domestic violence as a result of people being constrained have rocketed. And we shouldn't forget that aspect of these things either. Mm.
Okay, last question, Andrew, and I'm going to ask you to condense your answer if it's at all possible. Changing the subject a little bit, what differences will the UK feel from an economic or political perspective if Biden wins the election?
Well, I have to say that we should all, in my view, be down on our knees each night praying for a Biden victory. I think that Donald Trump has coarsened political life, and actually, in my view, he has brought democracy into a dangerous and difficult position. William Hague is very fond of quoting a discussion he had with a senior Chinese official in Beijing, where William was extolling the virtues of democracy, and the official looked at him in horror and said, "Goodness me, we couldn't possibly have democracy in China. They'd elect a peasant who'd immediately declare war on Japan." And you know, the argument for democracy and free societies around the world is diminishing. So, you know, I profoundly hope that Biden will win. It's not ideal that you've got if he does win at the age of 78, you know, he would by definition, I think, be a one-term president. But there are values and there are policies which I think he would pursue and which Donald Trump does not pursue, which bind society, culture, freedoms, and decency in what is the most powerful country in the world. And for that reason, and those are the answers to your question. I think those are the policies and the values which he would champion and the people around him would champion. I think that we would all gain for that. I mean, in terms of a trade deal, in terms of some of the other specific interests Britain has, the illusory special relationship, Donald Trump, you know, may be better for Britain in theory on all of those. But never forget that America has this huge system of checks and balances. And just because the president wants to give Britain something on a trade deal doesn't mean that the trade negotiators and the interests back home there will give it.
Okay, I'm sure that Donald Trump supporters might disagree with some of your answer there, Andrew. But no, thank you very much. I'm sure we'd all like to give Andrew a big word of thanks for this session. And we would like to thank you for attending. We hope to see you all in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you very much and see you then.